Enterprise Linux Security is brought to you by TuxCare, a company that helps you modernize your Linux security. Definitely check out TuxCare to see how they can help you automate Linux patching while minimizing downtime, staying compliant, and ensuring business continuity. Check them out at TuxCare.com.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to Enterprise Linux Security, episode 101. How you doing, Zhao?
All good. As always, a pleasure. Lots of things changed since the last time we recorded.
Yeah, I'm actually on camera for those that are watching the video version because I'm still working out the studio, but I have a green screen and I learned how to use it in OBS, so I guess that'll be good enough for now.
And that was exactly what I was referring to. No other special event happened since.
Yeah, lots of behind the scenes things that are happening at the company. Nothing that's going to be interesting to the audience. I mean, the usual backup audits and all that fun stuff. But anyway, all that's done and everything's backed up again because, you know, I actually do what I preach. So anyway, we have several stories to talk about today, one of which we've already talked about, but there's some, you know, additional information and a new report in regard to ransomware in healthcare, which is the worst place you could have ransomware because that's a life or death situation. Obviously, we'll talk about that. And Broadcom/VMware is the gift that keeps on giving. They have a gift, but I don't know how much of a gift it is, but it's a good thing. But at the same time, we'll get into it.
And then we also have a story about CISA and some more recommendations. I mean, it's like we're rehashing stories, but it's not really that. It's just that these topics keep cropping up back over and over again, and we can't really get past them because, one, they're important. Second, they're just everywhere. And third, they end up being interesting even if we're repeating the same stuff that we've said before. The part about, and we can start with about part about ransomware. So for some context, a few days ago at the time of recording this, that's at the start of November, there was this meeting between the World Health Organization, which you might recall from seeing all over the news during the pandemic, and the UN Security Council, which needs no introduction. And interestingly, the topic of that discussion was ransomware, specifically ransomware in the healthcare sector. And I mean, stuff has to be important to reach that level, and it's finally getting the attention that it deserves at the highest level possible. So, yeah, we'll be talking a bit about that.
Yep, absolutely. May as well just dive right into it. So ransomware, as I'm sure everyone knows, is holding your data for ransom. And the ethical dilemma here, well, there's no ethics about this, but you know, when you're faced with this, it's do you pay, do you not? We always recommend not. The article that's linked to in the show notes from the United Nations, I think it was like over 30% of people that pay ransoms don't actually get their data back. So that was one of the things that I liked about the article because it puts a number on it. We already knew that. We already knew if you paid the ransom, you may or may not get your data back. Probably won't. In this case, we have a number to attach to it. So it's one thing for your family photos to have ransomware get locked down. That sucks. But when it's healthcare, I mean, you have life-saving machines hooked up to human bodies. I mean, that's the level of importance this is. And then the article talks about in the past with past events where they would have to assign runners at hospitals to run and grab papers, physical papers, anytime a surgeon, for example, needs a case history or something like that. So you can imagine not only the life and death aspect of it, but it just puts everything into chaos. And meanwhile, people are there just trying to get better. And, you know, just imagine having a life-saving procedure and then, there's ransomware. We can't access anything.
And there's always this argument. Yeah, sure, but 50 years ago, we used to do, people would get operations and would get procedures and everything would happen perfectly fine and we didn't have all those issues and we didn't have computers running the show. And that's absolutely true. But the thing is, in the meantime, procedures have gotten more complicated, the treatments have gotten more complicated, doctors have become trained in the way that we do things right now, not 50 years ago.
Right.
And everything relies on this. So you have this whole infrastructure set up relying on having information available when they need it, in most cases, right at the operating table, when they need that background information or when they need that right dosage to apply to somebody and they need to check their background story and their other interactions with other drugs. And when those systems don't give you the response in the amount of time that you actually need, then people's lives might suffer. And it's interesting that, like you said, they actually put numbers to this. Those 30% that don't get, that pay the ransom and never get their data back, that's, again, impressive, but that's not totally unexpected. It's the no honor among thieves thing. It's expected that when you're dealing with shady individuals that don't really mind ransoming hospitals and this type of places and don't mind affecting the lives of people this way, not giving you the keys back when you pay them, it's like, it's part to what of what they're doing, and it's to be expected. It's nothing really special for that to happen. It's just an eye-opener that, again, paying is not the right course of action in this situation. We always recommend not paying precisely and especially because of this.
Right. And it also sends the message that the company might pay again. So now if they paid once, they could be, you know, especially more attractive for this to happen to them again. I mean, and not only that, even if they don't get attacked again, they're sending a message to threat actors that, you know, it pays. And the money was ridiculous. Like, it's, and the article refers to it as an economy. They refer to ransomware as an economy, and rightfully so, because it has a lot of money going through it to make it an economy, legal or not. There's, you know, millions upon millions of dollars here. I thought I saw like over 100 million mentioned in the article. I mean, it's incredible. And then the amount of money that it takes to recover. One company mentioned in the article took 37 days to recover from a threat from one of these events.
And we're talking about situations that shut down the entire infrastructure. The entire hospital is taken down. We have an episode back, I don't know how many, in which specific episode it is, but we look at the actual economic model behind ransomware, how this is, there's an entire economic model in place where you have the people that find the victims, the people that handle the actual software and the payments and laundering the money and all kinds of things. And all of those are moving parts that are part of this process and part of this crime model.
Right.
It's very complex. It's highly professional. And again, I love saying this, but it's highly professional at this point. And the problem with this, the main problem, why this has reached the UN level, is that the solution for the problem has to be global. It can't be solved at the state level. It doesn't matter which state. The US can solve this alone. The UK can solve this alone. Europe, the Union cannot solve this alone. No single region or country can solve this alone. It has to have a global solution. It has to have law enforcement working together across multiple jurisdictions, across multiple countries. And the unfortunate thing is that the way things are going right now, and I'm not making any judgment around particular choices on particular countries, but the current trend towards protectionism and isolationism in many countries around the world right now actually harms this and is detrimental to finding a solution to this problem, because countries will be less inclined to working together. And that's a right. problem. That's a tangible problem that we are going to be feeling for the foreseeable future in cybersecurity, because as long as there are haven states for this type of criminals, and there are states that we can't deal with for multiple reasons,
right.
that are harboring these criminals, we will never fix the problem. This has to be solved globally, with everybody agreeing that it's a problem and that action needs to be taken.
And that's one of the main reasons why this perpetuates human nature also. You know, the thing is, if people learned lessons in the industry and took advice, and I mean, obviously security would still be a problem, but it's like we can't change people's behaviors, but because of human nature, and people don't like change. But at the same time, that's exactly what needs to happen. People need to change their behaviors. They need to be comfortable and allow themselves to be vulnerable to, you know, we have to try something new here. This isn't working. And it's the weakest link. It just takes one weak link. And that's what makes this so hard.
Another thing that it's pointed out that came out of this meeting was, and this isn't a problem that affects just the economy. Inequality is a real problem, not just between people, but between different states as well. There are states right now out there, the vast majority of states don't have the resources, the know-how, or the ability to properly identify the people that are doing these crimes when they happen within their borders. They don't have the ability to respond to these threats, and they don't have the infrastructure to properly deal with this, or even to cooperate with other states. And inequality there is actually helping the criminals finding these safe havens from which to operate from. And until you address the inequality problem, this isn't solvable.
Right.
And people need to understand that. This is a problem that we're going to have to face for many, many years to come, because this isn't solvable by single states acting alone or by small groups of states acting alone. It has to be global, it has to be everybody, and it has to be all at once.
Yeah, you have to have a pulse on it. You have to know what's going on. I mean, it's not just the precautions that you take. It's keeping an eye on the industry to find out what the threat actors are doing, because, you know, they didn't just invent everything they want to invent and they're done. I mean, they're continually working to find new ways, just like the security industry is, which is kind of like this IT cold war between the two that's perpetuating everywhere. We're trying our best to secure our systems, doing our due diligence, and then threat actors are doing their due diligence to try to bypass those protections. So it's this cat and mouse game that's eternal. But we all have to recognize that we're all in the same fight. And if we don't, then we're all solving the same problem independently and individually, which means it's going to take that much longer for actual results to happen if they do at all.
And you need to address all the levels of the problem. You need to address the money laundering part. You need to address the infrastructure for payments that relies on cryptocurrencies and relies on bank transactions to happen. You have to address the actual IT level stuff. You have to fix your vulnerabilities. You can't leave your stuff without patches applied. You can't leave improperly secured systems running and exposed to the internet. All those basic stuffs that people keep telling you about and that you keep reading about it, and that, oh, this basic stuff, I'm never going to fall for that. Yes, you will, like everybody else. And that comes as an eye-opener the first time that it happens, but it happens to you and it happens to me and it happens to everybody. Everybody will fall for this sooner or later. And just thinking that you don't, it's a recipe for disaster.
And it's interesting because we always have to maintain or remember that humans are imperfect. So it just takes one missed click. You know, one unintentional click is all it takes. And anybody could make that mistake. I don't care how long you've been in security. I don't care how long you've been in the industry. Everyone's human and prone to mistakes, but we have to keep vigilant just to make sure that we don't, you know, put our companies under just because of a bad decision. But that's really what we're up against right now. One wrong move and, you know, that could change the whole company right then and there.
And to address that, we have organizations like CISA. Now we're moving into the next story. Mm-hmm. We keep talking about CISA because they're actually, it's a federal agency in the US. They actually do good work. And you might not think so because it's a federal agency and government and you might not like that, but they are actually coming out with good recommendations and the steps that they're taking are in the right direction. Mm-hmm. Every now and then they come out with new recommendations. They have these known exploit vulnerability lists of stuff that they have seen in the wild being exploited, actively exploited, and they publish that information. And every now and then they come out with recommendations about that. Not long ago, I believe a couple of weeks, a month ago, something like that, we mentioned that there was this mandate from CISA that all federal agencies would have to patch vulnerabilities on their non-exploited vulnerability list within 21 days. And that was a good move. Right now, they're coming out with another proposal that will even further tighten those time periods there to patch. So they're coming out with a recommendation that says that you need to patch vulnerabilities that are on the known exploited vulnerability list within 14 days. And that's massive. And that's definitely a step in the right direction. Any time that that interval gets tightened is a good move.
It really is.
That's for the ones that are in the known exploited vulnerability list. For others of unknown exploitability status, you have 15 days or 21 days, depending if it's critical or high risk. And again, this is just a proposal. You had elections, who knows if it's actually going to come out or not, if it's actually going to get implemented or not. But regardless of that, it's still a good proposal. What they're proposing is actually good. It's a good cybersecurity posture if you tighten up the schedules between your patching activities. It doesn't really matter if it's your decision or if it's mandated, as long as you patch earlier. That's always a good move.
It really is. I personally feel like 14 days is a long time, but tightening it at all is a good idea. Like you said, it's amazing that these challenges are still challenges today when it comes to installing updates. I mean, yeah, we have things like live patching that make it easier. We have unattended upgrades. Every distribution has its own flavor of that from what I've seen. So there's almost always a way to enable automatic updates on things, but it still doesn't happen. And I think that there's tooling we could still use. I mean, some libraries are harder to patch than others, especially if a service needs to be restarted. But it's incredible that, you know, everything just isn't easier when it comes to installing updates, but we still have to do it. We still have to get it done because, you know, you're just leaving the door wide open if you don't install your updates.
And you're going to get that ransomware in sooner. Again, this is a proposal right now. It, regardless of what status it finally reaches or not, it will only affect federal agencies in the US. But if it's good enough for federal agencies to meet, it should be good enough for everybody else to also follow suit. And again, you might not like it. It's regulation. People tend to immediately dislike that for some reason. But in this specific area, in this specific field, the tighter we can make regulations, the more stringent we can make regulation, it's better for everybody. Mm-hmm. Having an organization be breached and data leaked actually doesn't affect just that organization. If you leak a password list from organization A, it's very likely that if they tried the same passwords on your accounts, some might match. We're human. We tend to follow some patterns. We might choose the same passwords or very similar, even if we like to believe that we're all unique and special in our own ways. We tend to follow the same patterns. The passwords at one organization will likely match one or two in your own organization. So the less organizations that are breached, the least amount of data that gets leaked, unfortunately, it's the better for everybody that gets reduced as much as possible. So any time that something like this gets proposed, it's a good idea to follow suit with what they're proposing. It's in everybody's best interest.
I like the fact that they added that a recommendation to keep a monthly inventory or update your inventory monthly with your assets, including the MAC address and the IP address. And this is interesting because I'm already doing that, not for security reasons, but, you know, I always, you know, in PF sense, I have everything as a static lease and everything gets logged and everything gets noted. And it's just the way I've been doing it. But that really is helpful because, you know, if someone brings a machine to work from home, you need to know if a new machine was added to that network. You need to know if there's a MAC address connected that isn't something that's allowed, what's being taken from the network, added to the network, and being able to understand where your assets are. And, you know, that kind of doesn't seem like a major security benefit, but it is, because you have to, by keeping inventory, you know what's on your network. And if something, you see a mysterious Raspberry Pi on your network that you didn't buy, well, that's a problem. And you should probably take a look at it.
If you see that, if if you see systems that are not using multi-factor authentication, then that's a problem. They make good recommendations in this proposal. It's the basic stuff that we've covered over and over again. Keeping your inventories up to date, making sure that you're using multi-factor authentication in all of your systems. That's also a given. We can't really explain much more of why that's important if you haven't understood it by now. There's no amount of explanation that's going to give it.
And a lot of these recommendations are just like you said, things that we've recommended before, and even before this podcast, many other people in the industry have also recommended. The usual suspects like multi-factor authentication, preventing unauthorized USB devices, and things like that. So they're very standard recommendations, but you know, the my opinion is, if people were doing these things, they would need to make recommendations. So we can hate the government influence all we want, but if people were doing the right thing, then they wouldn't even have needed to make any recommendations at all. But because people can't seem to secure their systems, now CISA's going to have some recommendations.
You know, this type of conversation reminds me of that teacher that tells you that, yeah, you need to talk to that colleague of yours that isn't attending classes because he really needs to come in. So you're actually punishing the people that are doing this thing correctly by giving them information they already know. And it's essentially what we're doing with our audience. We're telling the people in our audience, they don't need to hear this again. They're the ones that already know this because they've been following us for a while. So you guys that are listening to this podcast, you already know this stuff. But I'm pretty sure that either you work at a place where people don't know it, or you know people that still don't follow this type of recommendations. Everybody has those horror stories of passwords on sticky notes on monitors, or default passwords everywhere, or just systems always logged in with no lock timeout. That type of things. It's the basic stuff that gets you.
Hackers
won't go out of their way to hack your systems. They'll try a couple of easy things. If they can't get in that way, they'll just move to the next because they're wasting their time. Unless it's a highly specific targeted attack, they won't bother. You're not that important. Whatever you have is not that important. They will try the basic stuff. If that works, great. You're another victim. If that doesn't work, there's plenty of fish out there. Fixing the basic stuff will cover most of your cybersecurity profile and will lower your risk significantly. Getting your patches in on time, getting your multi-factor authentication in place, all of those things will address most of the problems that you'll face in cybersecurity. And you already know that. But you know people for sure that don't. Please spread the word. Please tell them to listen to this podcast. Please tell them to any random episode is fine. We repeat this very often, so they'll probably find it. But this is the type of stuff that needs to get out there as much as possible.
I think one of the hardest part for me when I was more green in the industry was being taken seriously. And I'm not talking about knowledge level. I mean, when I suggest a security precaution, and then upper management not wanting to go along with that. Maybe people on my team agree with me and they think that it's a good idea, but, oh, it's hard. It takes training, or, you know, two-factor authentication. Now we have to manage another thing, and now users are going to complain, and they do. And then it ends up being very difficult. My suggestion is whenever we talk about a company that's on the unfortunate side of the things and they've been breached, then write it down, you know, copy the URL and the title and just in a text document. Anytime we mention it in the podcast, and you can even go back to our older episodes and just look at the related articles section that's in each and then just pull those. And then if you need any, you know, anything to help convince upper management to, you know, increase security, give them examples. This site got breached by ransomware. This site had been breached because of lack of updating. And this site didn't have, or this company didn't have multi-factor authentication. I mean, for every one of the things on here, I think we probably have a story about what happens when you don't implement that fix.
And pro tip, it's never a good thing.
No. So my suggestion, keep a log and just use examples, because a lot of times, depending on how important IT is to your company, there might be some pushback when you want to implement something. But coming armed with knowledge about why you want to implement something and what could happen if you don't, I think might go a little bit further if you're not already doing that. So,
and if you're wondering why we keep repeating stories from CISA and CISA-related, even though they're a federal agency in the US and just in the US, it's because it will affect all the suppliers of the federal government in the US. Right. And all of the suppliers of those suppliers and all the way down the chain. And that becomes global pretty quickly. So if mm-hmm. it affects them, it will affect your suppliers as well, and it will affect you in place. So you will eventually have to follow the same regulations whether you are in the US or not.
Right.
Yeah, globalization for you.
We were just talking about this because it might have even been the last episode where we mentioned that, you know, products rarely stay within the territorial boundaries. So something that's made for the United States, I think you brought this up, that's manufactured for the United States, it's not likely that they're going to have, a B version firmware for the UK and for, you know, all those other places. They're probably just going to have the one firmware, and the only thing that's going to change is the cardboard box. Other than that, if it is a physical product. But the fact is, I mean, when you have these devices, and that's why we keep talking about it, because even if, like you said, if you don't live in the United States, you're doing business with someone who does, and they are impacted by this. They often have to abide by rules that may not even exist in their country. So, yeah, these things really do affect everyone.
However unfortunate or not that is.
Yep.
Talking about, and let's cover this one really quickly, the WordPress one. This is a really quick story. You've probably seen this mentioned everywhere because it has been everywhere, this story. But there have been some shenanigans going around WordPress. This has been happening for over a month right now. And I'm not going to go in detail about what's actually happening because it's a mess and it's actually pretty hard to follow the entire story. But WordPress and WP Engine are two separate entities. They're actually represent two separate companies. They're not very small. They handle around $15 million annually. That's pretty massive. And right now they're behaving like those little children in the playground. It's my ball and I'm not going to let you play with it.
Oh, no. So
what's happening here is that one company says the other is not contributing enough to open source, so they're no longer letting them use their stuff. And then the other company says, no, that's not really what's happening. We do contribute a lot, so now you're not going to be using our stuff. And all the while, it's gotten to the point that the CEO in one of the companies said that if any of our employees isn't happy about the way that we're handling this situation, we will pay you a good bonus and you can resign and there's no problem. And they have paid. And there's lots of people leaving those two companies, actually, because of this story, because it's actually a mess. The reason I'm bringing this up is not necessarily because this looks like a soap opera story or it's playing out like that, but because this actually has a cybersecurity impact as well. Everybody has sites running on WordPress. It runs the majority of websites out there, so it's very likely that your organization has if you don't have it personally. But since both of these companies represent the first WordPress itself and then the other one, a very large hoster of WordPress websites and some plugins in the WordPress space, there is a difficulty right now in getting updates for some of the plugins. Auto updates have been disabled and you're no longer able to check for updates for particular plugins that you might be using, and they're actually pretty popular plugins, or you might not get access to specific features of WordPress because of this. It's a mess and you need to pay attention to the vulnerabilities. Knowing that there are companies looking at vulnerabilities in WordPress right now that are not divulging known vulnerabilities that they find because they're not certain if the current environment allows for the fixes to be delivered to everybody on time. It's that critical and it's that silly of a situation to be in. So
it really is. Yep. Yeah. And we use WordPress, but I'm not endorsing it because, you know, just happenstance. It's not, oh, we use WordPress because we love it. No, it just was what was used at the time the site was made. But I swear one of these days I'm going to get off of WordPress. That's my goal.
Actually, right now, lots of people are thinking like you.
Yeah, it's the lock-in is what makes it hard, because especially for a content creator like myself, I'll have an extension, you know, for, well, one example is this podcast. That's a great example because I use an extension in WordPress for this podcast. So when I post the blog entry for the WordPress site, which I will do after we finish recording within an hour or so, part of the process is putting the URL for the MP3 file that ultimately gets served. So even then, WordPress is serving the podcast. So switching it is finding another podcast distribution and redoing that, plus SEO extensions and all these other things. And I think that makes it really hard for people to get off of WordPress. And I wonder if that's why so many people are on it.
Who would think that walled gardens are a good idea?
Nice.
Anyhow.
No.
Anyhow.
Yeah, fair enough.
We have another company doing weird things story, which in this case is a follow-up from our previous episode. VMware, that recently got acquired by Broadcom, is coming out with a change that is positive, is it? So Workstation, the personal use virtualization software that they have, and they have had for over 20 years now, is now free for all users. Congrats, everybody can use it. You don't have to look up a key generator online and get some nasty viruses while you're doing that. It's not free. You can download it and it will work. You don't need a license for it. Hooray. It's free for PC, for Windows, Linux, and even the Mac OS version Fusion is also going to be free. That's great news, right? Okay, so obviously there's a catch to this. The catch being that they are now... Okay, there's a bit more than the catch, but the trick here is that while they are releasing it as free, they're also switching the virtualization layer from being their own proprietary one to using whatever is present in your system. So on Windows, that means that they're going to be using the hypervisor that Windows provides, specifically Hyper-V. On Linux, they're going to be running on top of KVM. On macOS, it's going to be running on top of whatever happens there, which I have no clue. But on Linux specifically, this is now running on top of KVM, which immediately brings to attention a few points. First, KVM is doing great if VMware is running on top of it. KVM is a great product. It's a great virtualization program. It's amazing. Secondly, one of the great selling points that VMware has always pushed, and I've been in conversations with vendors when they're trying to push VMware that says, oh yeah, you have this great feature set that you can only find on VMware. You have this great 3D pass-through and you have VDIs that you can use and you have lots of great features that you won't find on any other virtualization platform. Here's the thing. Moving on top of the other third-party hypervisors right now for Workstation, you continue to have exactly the same feature set. Meaning that for all of these years, all of these features that VMware has always announced as being exclusive to their virtualization stack could actually run on top of any hypervisor. And that's massive. It means that it doesn't really matter the hypervisor that you're using. That software stack doesn't need it to run. And they've been luring people into their ecosystem for years, claiming that it does. And right now, with this move, with releasing this and running this on top of KVM and whatever else, it means that it doesn't really need to be that way. For one, it's great to know that. And I don't really understand how they thought this through, or if they thought this through at all. Because as soon as people understand this, that they can get the same feature set on whatever hypervisor is out there, they have no incentive to remain with VMware, especially with the price hike that they have been doing in the past few months.
Right. It would have to have some massive incentive, I would think. It's from the feature standpoint, because basically they're packaging up something that we all already have. Now, you could argue that the GUI tools that we have with some of these technologies, when they're baked into the OS, aren't as good, because when you have a company that could develop the UI layer around the virtualization stack, they could add features and make it more user-friendly. But to me, that seems like the only thing they can hope for, because the feature set is already there. We already have access to it on every platform. So if they want to compete here, which I guess they're not competing because it's free. I'm so confused. They're really going to have to develop something with the feature set or ease of use that's going to make it attractive. Otherwise, you know, Linux people are already using Vert Manager, for example. So, you know, we could just continue to use that if we're not attracted by this offering.
One of the reasons that would get the company or an individual to work with Workstation in the past, with VMware Workstation in the past, was to prepare VMs that would then be moved to vSphere or to ESXi or something like that, and they would work exactly the same. You could create a VM there and export it and import it on the other side, and it would work flawlessly. You no longer have that need. It's no longer required to be running their services. You can run on top of KVM, why move to anything else? If you have the VM on KVM, great. There are great management tools on top of it. You don't need VMware's infrastructure to do that anymore. And they have come out and said absolutely that. So, yeah.
So someone could use their tooling to develop something to move everything off of VMware and actually use it to do mass migrating. I'm calling it right now. Someone develops something that allows mass migrating to happen because they opened it up and maybe exposed something that a developer needed just that little bit of a feature set or something in their code. And now they're using KVM. So I can see how they're doing it and replicate it a lot easier. So I think that's going to be interesting to see how that turns out.
I know for a fact AT&T has 8,000 servers that they really want to get off VMware. So, yeah, they're actually suing VMware just for that because they're not offering them support anymore. And they might be very inclined to moving their stuff elsewhere. And this is a good way of showing that they don't really need VMware for anything.
Yeah, I feel like this is a solution looking for a problem to solve in a way. I mean, there could be benefits depending on, you know, when this comes out, because I guess we should have mentioned that it's not out yet. So my understanding, and this is what we talked about beforehand, is that there's no more support for VMware Workstation unless you have a support agreement. They did say that they would honor it, but they're not going to allow you to have a new support agreement. And the replacement isn't out yet because we're going to get into a Phoronix story, and I think we're talking about maybe a year or so from now. I mean, this isn't something that's going to be available right away. I mean, yes, I believe the products are free right now, but the new KVM version is not out yet.
This is actually where things get a bit murky right now. There's this developer that works for VMware and used to work for VMware. Now it's Broadcom, that created a pull request for the Linux kernel to integrate some of the plumbing that's necessary to make this work. And when asked by Phoronix, he said that, this will be ready in early to 2025, something like that, so it's not for right now. However, 10 days immediately after that was submitted, the company announced that it was available. So, again, I don't know if it's poor planning, if it's poor communication, if they don't know how to handle the communication of these decisions or not, or if there's any planning at all going around. But they're tripping up all over themselves with this. To me, right now, they're just looking for the best way to avoid working on Workstation or Fusion anymore. They want to cut their losses. They want to cut their costs when doing any actual development work. So they already know that people would be angry if they simply stopped working on Workstation and Fusion, so they took the next best thing, which is we don't want to do it, we'll just take what everybody else is using, which is KVM or Hyper-V, and work on top of that, so that we don't have to do the actual development work. We don't actually have to have hundreds of people developing stuff for Workstation and Fusion anymore, we'll just take what's out there and use and work on top of it. They're cutting costs right there. They still can still say that they have the product available so that people don't get angry with them. But they're not actually doing any of the heavy lifting.
It's a check the box solution, presumably, more than anything else, or checking the box that they have that in their portfolio. I wonder, what are the odds that at some point ESXi follows and then they change that to KVM also? And then, I mean, I'd be kind of worried if I was a VMware developer right now, because, you know, if they're using, it's one thing to have a whole staff to develop something proprietary, but when you're utilizing something open source, then depending on the feature set, you may or may not need as many people, and therein lies the rub. It kind of seems obvious to me, but maybe I'm wrong.
It does look like it's exactly that that's going to happen, doesn't it? That what they just did with Workstation Infusion is exactly what's going to happen with ESXi in a few months down the line. I mean, people might not like it, but ESXi is basically just a Linux rehash. They rebrand some stuff, they repackage some of the stuff, but it's essentially Linux under the hood. At some point, they're just going to stop adding their own virtualization layer and they're going to run with KVM out of the box.
It almost reminds me of when Canonical switched from Unity to GNOME, because now that's one less thing that they have to develop, and then they just go along with GNOME, sunset Unity, just to develop snap packages and this thing and that thing and get into the same position all over again, developing all these things. You know, Canonical wanting to, you know, lower developer overhead by switching to GNOME and not developing their own desktop. And now VMware essentially seems like they don't even want to develop their own hypervisor anymore.
Who knows? This might just be a proof of concept that their features can work on top of KVM just fine. And if people don't complain that there are issues, ESXi is just the next step. vSphere will come just a little along. And sooner rather than later, you're going to see their entire offering on top of KVM. Which is great for KVM. It's mature enough to be used that way.
As soon as they do that, you know just as well as I do that Open ESXi is the next thing made by someone else that, you know, has an out for them and forks it. And then we have the OpenOffice, LibreOffice thing all over again, with the exception being the exorbitant licensing cost. And then I wonder if they do go that direction and go down the KVM path for ESXi, then that's especially making it unattractive to pay for it at that point, because, I mean, we already have all of it. Yeah. Available to us right now. So
the sales execs at VMware are going to have a really tough time selling that product if that happens. They can no longer extract the inordinate amounts of money that they're asking people for their deployments if all that they're doing is repackaging KVM. People will just repackage KVM themselves.
What sales rep wouldn't love selling people something they already have? I mean, isn't that the most powerful sales rep ever? In this case, like we said before, this whole Broadcom VMware thing, I'm calling it now. We're going to be talking to this about this on and off for at least a year minimum. Yeah. And probably even then some after that.
At the very least, until Broadcom offloads VMware to somebody else. You can quote me on that one when it happens.
Just like you could quote me on Canonical being bought up by Microsoft one day. I swear that's going to happen. I'm telling you. Anyway, don't take that too seriously.
I'm pretty sure this one will happen sooner than that.
Oh, that one will happen. That one's way more likely. I think it's pretty telling the direction they're going. They seem to be more in a reactionary state after the buyout, because it's, you know, their decisions just seem like just-in-time decisions. We have a thing, we need to do something about it. Okay, we bought this thing, and we need to do something about this. We need to do something about that. And then the decision's not being well thought out. It's like they're buying something, or they bought something that they don't even know how to manage.
And that's the thing, right? They spent a huge amount of money in the acquisition, and right now they're running the company to the ground. Right. VMware lost all the public trust that it had. It lost all the reputation that it had. All of these moves are just showing that their technology is not that special, actually, and people can replicate this with whatever hypervisor they have, so it's not something that's that valuable anymore. And they're running the company to the ground. They will immediately try to offload it as soon as they get a good offer.
XCPNG and Proxmox are looking fairly good right now.
Yeah. Okay, that covers the stories that we had for today. Thank you, everybody who joined. As always, it was a pleasure, and until the next one.
See you next time.
Bye.